got a sprain or an itch, pain that's swelling or twitch, call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky. I call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. Now that New Year's and the New Year's Day resolutions have passed, I'm asking you, how many of you have promised to go on a diet? How many of you have already quit that diet? Now, if you answered in the affirmative, then you're not alone. In fact, the number one thing most dieters have in common is the lack of, well, let's call it stick-with-itness.
In a survey just out this week, 2 out of 5 quit within the first 7 days. 1 out of 5 lasted a month, and the same number, just 20%, made it to the 3-month mark.
So what is the solution to successful dieting? Let's talk about 5 things that you can do to keep you on that diet and thus succeed by losing weight and sustaining that weight loss. Many, if not most, dieters think that feeling hungry means you're successful in your diet. However, chronic hunger generally indicates that your diet is imbalanced or inadequate. This can cause your body to conserve energy and resist weight loss.
To lose pounds and inches without perpetual hunger pangs, you have to include healthy foods that boost the feeling of fullness called satiety and keep you feeling fuller for a longer period of time.
Foods that do increase satiety include those that are high in lean protein. Now, these include organic eggs, poultry, fish, beans, and lentils, as well as those with fiber. And that includes those with fruits, vegetables, whole grains, beans, and good fats, meaning avocado, nut seeds, as well as extra virgin olive oil and coconut oils. For example, a 350-calorie meal of 1 cup of vegan black bean soup, topped with 1/4 of a chopped avocado, 2 cups of grilled asparagus, and 1/2 cup of cooked quinoa will leave you feeling a whole lot fuller than the same 350-calorie frozen diet dinner.
If you have never tried quinoa, you are in for a treat. It is one of those foods that is certainly not as popular as rice and potatoes, but can easily be incorporated into tasty meals. Believe me, Dr. Lasky and I eat many a meal made with quinoa.
That's spelled Q-U-I-N-O-A. And you can find it at most health food stores and even regular supermarkets, which is where we buy it, in the grain area, and that's where rice is sold normally. Another smart strategy is to choose your foods that allow you to eat more volume without racking up excess calories. So what do we include in this group? Well, water-rich fresh fruits and veggies and airy starches, like organic popcorn. Yes, I did say popcorn. And puffed whole grains.
1/2 cup of organic corn provides about 15 grams of carbohydrate, about the same amount in the 3 cups of organic popcorn, and 1/2 cup of brown rice packs about 22 grams of carbs, roughly 8 more than 1 cup of puffed brown rice.
First, make a list of the foods that you could easily do without and which you would be happy to forgo forever. It's a critical question because long-term weight control is a lifetime commitment. We don't want any temporary fixes here. We want real change that is easy and enjoyable to follow.
Using a diet that works 1 week and then allows you to gain the neck only leads to failure through anger or depression and culminates in either binge eating or diet abandonment.
Next on our list to do is a ditching of all or nothing mentalities. In that mindset, one small diet deviation means that you failed. So what happens? You might as well quit it, right? And that keeps you from staying with that diet. In fact, you need to allow yourself small splurges in ways that reduce the chance of overeating. Let me give you an example of this. Maybe once a week you can split a dessert with someone at a restaurant, or just buy 1 cookie from a bakery rather than bringing home the whole box.
You may also consider nutrient-rich, weight loss-friendly foods that feel like flourishes, such as almond butter, avocado, and dark chocolate.
Not being able to look forward to and savor your food is a surefire recipe for disaster. When my kids were in elementary school, I was on the local school advisory committee which was called the LSAC. At that time, Jacksonville was considering year-round school with mini vacations rather than full vacations such as summer vacation. It was and still is my opinion that this is not a good idea on a number of fronts. One being that children do better at school when they have something to look forward to. I remember my own experiences. Each year, the day after Labor Day, when summer vacation ended for me and I had to return to the first day of school, my first thought was on next year's summer vacation and what my friends and I would do. Without that thought, school would have, well, I guess, could you say, been more doleful, as we would have nothing to really look forward to.
The same is true for dieting. If there is nothing to look forward to, then you set yourself up for failure.
One huge problem are friends and family members that sometimes say things like, "You look fine, you don't have to lose weight." And many dieters report feeling guilty or are actually enticed into eating foods that they really are trying to avoid.
One recent study found that friends who eat together consume more food than those paired with strangers.
It appears that friends give each other visual as well as verbal permission to overeat. So to fix this, break that eating as entertainment pattern. Rather than scheduling social time around happy hour and dinners, mix things up.
Go to a play rather than a movie where munching on popcorn and candy isn't allowed.
Maybe you can go out dancing and volunteer to be the designated driver so you can sip on water all evening. No problem asking friends for support. Tell them why your goals are so important to you. For example, you could say that eating helps you sleep better, so maybe you'll be more productive at work, or maybe it'll get rid of your heartburn. It may even keep your migraines at bay.
Remember that studies have shown time and time again that we are practically programmed from birth to use food emotionally.
We tend to bond and celebrate over meals. How many times have you received candy and cookies and other foods as gifts, especially around Christmas? We often bring others food in times of crisis, and we even use food as a means of comfort. Terrible day at work, a long-awaited promotion may both trigger you to eat.
When you are really sad, angry, or scared, and you know that eating ice cream is going to make you feel better right now, it is easy to push away thoughts about how you'll feel tomorrow or detach your front goals that aren't quite relevant in that moment.
You can change that pattern. Understand that it will not happen overnight, maybe not even a week or maybe not even in a month. But this shift can have dramatic impact on your weight. If you're feeling pulled towards the pantry, hop online and check out success stories. Read up on meditation. Do a little yoga. Get your mind off your eating.
We have all probably heard of the low-carbohydrate and low-fat diet. Well, a recent study showed that they were not linked with decreased total mortality.
Looking at nearly 40,000 U.S. adults, those who consumed a diet comprised of low carbs but high total protein and fat didn't see any reduced all-cause mortality risk. The same lack of association, as described in the JAMA, that's the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine, was seen with a low-fat diet as well. However, the authors reported that what did appear to bear a significant association on total mortality risk were the specific types and quality of macronutrients that were consumed.
A healthy low-carbohydrate diet meant low consumption of low-quality carbohydrate, but high consumption of plant protein and unsaturated fat.
This diet was tied to a 9% reduction in all-cause mortality risks, while consumption of an unhealthy, low-carbohydrate diet comprised of few high-quality carbohydrates, high in animal proteins, and high in saturated fats was associated with a 7% increased risk for death.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center.
I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 33 years.
We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care.
Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show. Now, in the news for the past several years, there have been the nanoparticles. Every time I hear that term, I think Star Trek and Mr. Spock. I don't know why. Nanoparticles. These are the small particles that can be used to deliver drugs to otherwise unreachable areas.
The spinal cord and part of the central nervous system can be difficult to treat, so they have been a focus of nanoparticle treatment. Our first question is, how do they work? And the second question is whether they do or do not work as expected.
Nanoparticles have been investigated for potential use in inflammation and injury treatment during the past decade. The key benefit that sets nanoparticles apart from previous treatments is the more localized effect that is possible, as compared with the systemic injections or generalized treatments. While nanoparticles can target specific sites, their administration can be more general, such as via IV, that's intravenous injections. This can allow for sustained treatment of injuries using drugs that might otherwise have toxic effects, limiting their use.
Not only that, certain methods allow for the time release of the drug, thereby limiting the number of injections needed. Injury to the spinal cord can result in paralysis, dangerous infections, and death.
And these injuries can be difficult to treat because there will be an inflammatory response to damage, and any existing medication can have serious side effects that are likely associated with the drug's toxicity to other organs.
In addition to delivering drugs, nanoparticles can be used to affect the immune system by moving immune cells around the body.
New research has focused on how immune cells can be reprogrammed to enhance the immune response to the damaged spinal cord and thereby improve regeneration.
Nanoparticles have been shown to enter immune cells and regulate their biodistribution, gene expression, and function.
This in turn is shown to lead to increased accumulation of nanoparticle positive immune cells at the site of the spinal cord injuries, coupled with the reduction of innate immune cells and gene expression of pro-inflammatory factors and increase of anti-inflammatory and pro-regenerative gene expression. That was a mouthful.
This shows that nanoparticles can affect the microenvironment and alter cellular phenotypes, the effect on gene expression, which drives the changes in phenotype and microenvironment, can be both short-term and long-term.
For example, when nanoparticles have been injected to upregulate anti-inflammatory factors, these changes are sustained in the long term and thereby further promote locomotor recovery. Researchers have published the results of their work where stem cell therapy has shown promise in a case of spinal cord injury. The results of their case study were published in a recent issue of the journal Mayo Clinic Proceedings. In the study, stem cell therapy has shown promise in a case of spinal cord injury.
This was essentially the first case and a phase one clinical trial to see the safety of the procedure. The team used mesenchymal stem cell treatment for the patient.
Mesenchymal cells, that means mesenchymal stem cells, are those that can differentiate into a variety of cell types, including bone, cartilage, muscle, and even fat cells. Now, Dr. Biden, the chief researcher, stated that they do not yet understand all of the necessary biology needed to achieve neurological recovery in paralyzed individuals.
One of our objectives in this study and future studies is to better delineate who will be a responder, why patients respond differently.
Regenerative medicine using stem cells have been one avenue that has been explored in the recent years to seek answers to paralysis caused due to spinal cord injuries. Now, according to Dr. Biden, despite the fact that not all may respond similarly, the study sparks hope among hundreds of thousands of individuals who suffer from traumatic spinal cord injuries each year. Now, if you're my age, you probably remember your parents telling you to go out and play, and you'd spend virtually the entire day outdoors with your friends, regardless of whether you lived in the city, the suburbs, or even the rural areas.
But more and more children spend their day with their eyes glued to a screen and their hands on a keyboard. mouse, or joystick.
Even schools have decreased their daytime activities with children. But more teachers are incorporating some form of movement into the school day, especially as the research is pretty clear. Physical activity in schools leads to better cognitive performance and fewer behavioral issues, not to mention cutting down on stress and anxiety.
One group in particular, the National Association of Physical Literacy, as well as similar groups, doubt the importance of teaching kids to move while they are young so that they will make movement part of their lives when they grow up.
So how much exercise do your kids really need? It all seems like a no-brainer, especially as research shows that childhood obesity seems to be getting worse.
The challenge, though, is persuading school administrations to consistently make time for physical activity. The problem is that many of them are pressed to meet stringent academic requirements and find the money to pay for some of the training.
But research has shown that physical activity genuinely benefits students. Want them to do better at math literacy? Then give them ample physical activity time. They also need to learn physical literacy.
In other words, teaching children the basics of movement so that they can stay active for life. This is not just idle talk or baseless fact. It works.
The National Association of Physical Literacy provides in-person and online training to teachers, and it communicates and provides something called Brainergizer videos. These are 5-minute movement videos developed in conjunction with the University of Connecticut based on research on what really stimulates the brain. No plug, but you can find this at NAPLUSA.org on the web. Dr. John Rady, an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, says that activity breaks during the school day create better learners because of the impact of movement on the brain.
You move, you stimulate all the nerve cells that we use to think with. And when you stimulate those nerve cells, it gets them ready to do stuff. And when you exercise, you turn on the attention systems.
Now, this means that you're paying better attention to what's happening around you. You're able to deal with more frustration, and you're able to stay with it longer.
Not only that, you are able to manipulate information by stimulating the brain, and that means turning on the front part of our brain to make it work better.
And that, my friends, is the real key to assimilating information as well as performing with that information. Now let's get back to teenagers, the students in the actual classroom. A recent study showed a review of 26 previous studies looking at the impact of physical activity on academic performance. What did they find? Well, they found that kids who get extra physical activity in school do better in reading as well as math.
The kids did not have to study more to get better grades and understanding. All they needed to do was increase their physical activity. Nowadays, the only kids that get to exercise in and after school were those good enough to be on teams.
Did you know that years ago, many schools, both private and public, had kids on teams even if they were not so spectacular? In fact, many schools in California in particular allowed anyone who wanted to be on a team could. More kids, more teams. They divided the kids to teams by ability, but the kids could all be on teams and therefore get exercise. There was a study published in the Journal of Pediatrics which involved more than 10,000 children between the ages of 4 and 13.
Again, it found that physical activity, especially physical education, improves behavior in classrooms and is a boost to academic achievement. And again, this was especially notable in math-related skills and reading.
There are, of course, many reasons for this. We've touched on a few. It helps with behavioral issues in the classroom because if kids are able to move, they're not going to have so much excess energy. They're going to be able to focus, and it's going to solve a lot of the sort of interpersonal issues that come up with kids as well because they're going to have an opportunity to get that energy out.
One teacher's third and fourth graders who were actively engaged in physical literacy were the highest scoring students in math and literacy within the district.
For this school year, not one student from this particular group had been referred to the office for a conversation with the principal. Before they started doing this physical literacy, they found that they had maybe one or two office referrals every month. And this particular grade level is at the highest risk for misunderstandings, disagreements, and even injuries at recess time, and they had none.
So we can see, at least in this instance, that the impact that it is has gone far beyond just the academic and the behaviors in the classroom.
But what if outside activities during school are just impossible?
Well, four out of five elementary schools in the United States are using videos from the education company GoNoodle to promote physical activity in the classroom.
The concept's simple. Today's kids have grown up with screens. So GoNoodle tries to use entertaining videos, often about 2 minutes in length, that will get the kids to move around and then either get back to their schoolwork or go off and play with friends. Now for a semi-local issue, one that seems to be affecting our Georgia neighbors in particular. In water, lead can be called a ghost poison. It has no taste or smell, and it's usually invisible.
Lead can stay in plumbing for years, gradually dissolving and flaking off into water we used for cooking and drinking.
Lead was banned from plumbing decades ago, but as the crisis in Flint, Michigan has shown, the threat remains.
In 2015, tests by Atlanta Water Department found levels of lead in one area were over the EPA's limit.
In plenty of water utilities around Georgia and the U.S., the system for testing lead in water is not working as it should, leaving people uninformed and unprotected. Researchers reviewed lead testing records obtained through the Open Records Act for water systems in Georgia, serving at least 10,000 people. What did they find?
First, they found a process hindered by poor record keeping and an apparent failure to follow a federal rule that's been on the books for more than 25 years.
Well, it seems that a good deal of the testing was performed only at sites with a lower risk for lead problems instead of focusing solely on those at higher risk. Of those water departments, 49 had also falsely labeled some lower risk sites as higher risk, giving the appearance they were following tested guidelines. And now Georgia testing practices have attracted the attention of the EPA's Office of Inspector General, an independent watchdog that polices the agency.
Then, in a November 2016 email, the OIG asked state officials to explain how they ensure that the high-risk homes are sampled for lead and about other challenges with lead sampling.
So let's get to the results of that study. The Northeast Georgia town of Demarest tested 30 addresses for lead in 2015. Only 10 were homes. Others included a hair salon, convenience stores, two doctor's offices, a firehouse, metal fabricator, well driller, the police department, and city hall. So why so many commercial sites in the tests? Although commercial sites may be tested under EPA rules, it's only allowed if a water system first runs out of highest risk homes. Apparently, the Georgia tests did not comply to these rules.
That same year, the Southwest Georgia city of Albany tested 7 businesses for lead, but labeled them on test forms as single-family homes.
In Savannah, Georgia's oldest city, water officials said they could not determine with any certainty what kind of plumbing was in the homes they tested because the records were lost. One supervisor for the Albany water system explained that they tested businesses after some residents declined to participate. He said the state had granted permission to do this.
Supervisor was asked why a city the size of Albany, which has more than 77,000 residents and more than 4,000 homes built in 1980s should need to have any lower risk sites in a sampling pool.
One researcher said that it is difficult to imagine how a utility of any size that has single family homes older than 1986 can't find enough high risk sites. Remember that the CDC says no amount of lead in blood is safe, and lead is especially dangerous to our children, who absorb as much as 90% more lead into their bodies than adults.
And researchers have found that even at low level, lead can damage a child's brain, lowering intelligence and damaging their ability to control their behavior and attention.
At higher levels, lead can affect growth and it can replace iron in the blood, leading to anemia and fatigue. In adults, lead poisoning can cause high blood pressure and damages the nerves as well as the kidneys. And it can also cause miscarriages.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana.
We've come to the end of another Hey